So my name's Matt. I have the privilege of being the minister here at Maybridge. I can recognise is the wrong word. I can see a few unfamiliar faces. How can I recognise unfamiliar faces? That's ridiculous. But lovely to have you with us, particularly. Do make yourself at home. Now, we are spending, as a church, a few months looking at 1 Peter in the New Testament. And it's a little bit like being given a cuddle and then slapped in the face with a wet fish. It's reassuring and challenging in equal measure. Now, last week we looked at some heavy stuff on having governments and civil leaders and what slavery is all about and why it's a bad thing and how it was understood in the first century. This week is nice and easy because we're talking about marriage and husbands and wives and submitting. So it's really easy stuff. Let me ask, has anybody watched the TV show The Handmaid's Tale? Anybody seen it? I've not watched it, but I had to do the book by Margaret Atwood at school. Anybody read the book? You had to, if you're a certain age, you had to do it at school. And it's pretty popular. And if you don't know the basic story, it's basically set in a future dystopia where many women are oppressed by men in a weird patriarchal society. And it's all justified by kind of this weird religious thing that's going on. And it's all very bleak. But sadly, it's a picture of what some people think Christianity says about men and women and marriage. And it's this ancient, horrible, controlling stuff that we need to break free from. And in fact, that may even have been your own experience. You may be thinking, that's actually happened to me, that people have sort of said, oh, I've got to do this or that because there's this one Bible verse or something, and it just seems terrible. And unfortunately, there are people in the world, bizarrely including some Christians, who think that a society where women are oppressed is a good idea. But everyone seems to forget that the world changed positively for women because of the teaching of Jesus and his followers. In reality, it's because of the historical Christian teaching that the equality of men and women is even a thing in the West, and that we have laws that oppose things like sexual exploitation. Christianity is the greatest force for women, married or not, that has ever been in the world. And it's the greatest thing for men too. So here's what Peter says to wives and husbands, and this is all about how to do marriage for God. That's my sort of subtitle for this. In context, Peter the author is addressing Christian people who are living in tricky places. And we have to bear in mind, in that society, virtually everybody was married. Here and now, about 40% of adults are single, so it's quite a big difference. And if you're not married right now yourself, you might think, well, what's this going to even have to do with me? Well, one, you might be married in the future, who knows? And two, you're part of a church community, and therefore you know plenty of people who are married, and surely God wants you to have an understanding of what that's all about and how to approach it with some understanding of what it means. So here we are. Now, this is going to sound, like I said, it's going to sound a bit Handmaid's Tale to begin with, but it's not, and we'll see why. Peter writes this, "Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behaviour of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives." First thing, as we said last week, submit is a very scary word to many people, especially women with experience of being badly treated by men. Verses like this have been misused as a weapon to tell women to do what they're told by men, who are both bad husbands and bad interpreters of the Bible, which is a terrible combination of things. Also, we said last week, and it's worth saying this again, submission is a choice made by the person submitting, not the person being submitted to. Submission is a choice made by the person submitting, not by the person being submitted to. If it wasn't a choice, there'd be no point in saying it. Peter is saying to Christian wives, this is important, women who happen to be Christians and married, you've got a choice here, but please use that choice to do something that's going to be really helpful. In that culture, women were normally expected to worship whatever God their husband worshipped. So for them to be Christians with husbands who weren't meant they could not have been being controlled at home in the first place. So in these verses, Peter is not trying to set up some sort of male superiority thing. He's not imagining a sort of 1950s stereotype family. He just wants more people to encounter Jesus and grow in following him. That's the thing. And so he's saying to the wives of husbands who are not Christians, you've got influence here. You've got influence. We'd like your husbands to meet Jesus too. You're a Christian, that's brilliant. They're not. How do we change that? It'd be great for him, it'd be great for you, it'd be great for your family. And interestingly, Peter does not say, well, you need to tell him this and explain this and have loads of really good thought through answers. He thinks the way to win over your husbands is to live a different life. Submit to your husband, prefer him over yourself. Think about what will be helpful for him. Doesn't mean let him use and abuse you, absolutely not. But in a healthy marriage context, try to love him more than you love yourself. This is not at all about saying the husband is superior in any way. Those words about purity and reverence that follow sound like he's saying really be super, super dull, but he's saying make your life attractive. Purity was about being of good character. Reverence was about being someone who took God seriously. This was the combination of things that would stand out to somebody who didn't know Jesus, and it still is. You can say all sorts of things. You can say whatever you like, but what you really stand for is seen in how you live your life. And Peter continues the thought, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Now, in high society at the time, it was all about complicated hairstyles and massive jewelry. And the celebrities of the day would have been really into these things. And it's not that Peter's saying, ladies, make yourselves look as ugly as possible. He's saying, don't make your looks the main thing in your life. Simple but challenging. Of course, even now, we're all too aware that beauty counts for a lot in our world, and people are judged by how they look all the time. We've made outer beauty so important that it's actually oppressive. People spending a fortune on clothes, diets, and even surgery to look as they can, good as they can, according to some sort of cultural standard. But God, be reassured, is interested in your inner beauty, the stuff that you can choose to be regardless of your bank balance. In the same vein, a gentle and quiet spirit is not about being necessarily introverted or becoming a librarian, but about being someone at peace, someone who doesn't have that driving need to be front and center, to get the attention. And that inner confidence and settled poise is a beauty that does not fade, and it's persuasive. If you're relaxed and at peace and secure in who God's made you to be, that will stand out in a culture which is anxious all of the time, like ours. We live in the most anxious culture that has ever been. To not be anxious, to be at peace with who God made you to be, is a powerful thing. Peter goes on to use an example from the Old Testament. He says, this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. What on earth is this about? This sounds peak Handmaid's Tale, doesn't it? Right at the start of the Bible, in Genesis 18, we see the story of Abraham and Sarah. And God has told Abraham he's going to be the father of a great nation, which sounds awesome. But Abraham and Sarah are really old, and they haven't been able to have children. It's all very strange. And so when Sarah is told again that she will indeed have a child, she laughs, because it's ridiculous. And then when questioned, she denies it. She actually tells a little lie. She says, I didn't laugh. Well, she did. And in the middle of this dialogue, she refers to Abraham as her Lord. Not as God, but in the same way that somebody might address a king or somebody very high up. And the point is that within the culture of her time, even though she's confused about the baby promise, and she's kind of joking about it, she still respects Abraham. That's what this is about. She holds him in high regard. And what's amazing is that actually Peter uses Sarah as a positive example of how to be a good wife. Even though she's not perfect, she tells a lie when she's afraid in a story, and Peter holds her up as this example. And he's not saying, ladies, call your husband Lord and give him sex or a pizza whenever he clicks his fingers. He's saying Sarah was a good wife because even though in her story there was pain around childlessness and some confusing promises, she's committed to her husband through all of these difficult things. And that's the example. That's the hard stuff. You'll be glad to know, we've got to it quickly, there's a message for husbands too. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Now, weaker here does not mean pathetic or flimsy. Physically, hopefully this is not controversial, men tend to be stronger than women in general. But more than that, at the time, women didn't have the same rights. If you were a woman, you were legally more vulnerable. Telling husbands to be considerate at the time was revolutionary. And the key idea in this line, if you sort of move away from the bits that seem really controversial, is where it says, heirs with you, to the men about their wives. In other words, you're co-equals. You're on the same level. In the first century, this was the wild bit, the controversial bit. Everybody would have assumed, men and women, that men were greater, more valuable. And Peter is saying, and through him God is saying, that's not true. And the reason is nothing to do with modern gender politics or what it says on a sociology degree. It's to do with how men and women are positioned before God. Heirs, of course, are people who inherit something. It's passed on to you. Both men and women, according to this, are heirs. Both men and women are God's children. There is complete equality of value. And this isn't new. This was right there at the beginning of the Bible, men and women created as equal partners. It was often forgotten or ignored, but it's been there from the start. Real gender equality was not invented in the 1970s. It was baked into creation. Men and women are not the same, but they are of precise equal value. And right at the end there, of this little line, Peter says to do this to the men so that this will not hinder your prayers. Which is a bit of a weird, I thought this was a bit of a weird way to end that line of thought. What's he saying? Peter is saying, and he's addressing married men in this bit, if you don't treat your wife well, it will hinder your prayer life. In other words, your walk with God, your connection with God will be obstructed if you treat your wife badly. This was so different from every other worldview or religion, which saw women as secondary. Here was Peter, a gruff, opinionated northerner. I can relate to him. A first century fisherman. I can't relate to that. Who'd been so changed by Jesus that he was writing to tell other men to treat their wives as co-heirs and equals. And think of this. You have to know, Peter would not have met anybody in his entire life until Jesus who would have thought this way. And he's obviously taken it on. And now we live in a world where, thankfully, it's become more prevalent to see men and women in this way. So what do we do with this? Here's just a few thoughts of what to do with this passage if you're a follower of Jesus. And you might be thinking, I don't really know what this has to do with me. Here we are. First one, see your relationships, even the closest ones, as opportunities to represent Jesus. In the passage, Peter takes the time to address women who are married to men who are not Christians. It's a little reminder that God is aware of our different situations. It's not like God is saying, oh, you Christian woman, you married somebody who's not a Christian, life is over for you now. The question is, how can you be as useful as possible in representing Jesus to your spouse? Or anybody, actually. It's unlikely that nagging them to come to church is going to be very effective. Peter's advice basically is live attractively. Most people who become Christians as adults do so because they're impacted by the lives of people they respect. In fact, that's how most people arrive about their beliefs about anything. Books and discussions and church services have their place, great. But people are mostly influenced by people that they like. In a marriage, you are with somebody who presumably liked you enough to marry you, and so you've got an amazing opportunity to demonstrate the way of Jesus actually does work. And it's a challenge because obviously in a marriage, you see all the good and the bad. But who's in a better position to show someone what our God is like than in your closest relationship? And be encouraged. Peter's underlying assumption is people will be won over. There are people who will become Christians. Not all of them, but people will. And we've seen that that's true. People get to know Jesus in all sorts of ways, books, videos, dreams, conversations. But what is most powerful is being close to somebody who follows Jesus already and seeing the change. So if it's your spouse or your child, your best friend, the opportunity is you might just be the best person to demonstrate the Christian life to them and show them the person that you follow. And that's probably going to take time. And you may be misunderstood. And there's no guarantees that they'll respond how you'd like because it's between them and God. But your part is to represent him and leave the results to him. Very simple. But also with this, don't beat yourself up if you make a mistake. You can't be perfect. If you make a mistake, that doesn't mean you're a bad Christian because the Christian message was never that you were good anyway. So if you get a bit irritable or you let out some bad language or you forget their birthday, it doesn't mean your representing of Jesus to them is all over, it's all finished. Sometimes actually making a mistake, big or small, and how we deal with it and look to rectify it can in some way point someone to Jesus more than pretending that we've got it all together because of course we don't. That's not the message. Second thing, see marriage as a God-given institution that demonstrably helps society to function. When Peter was writing, the wider context was encouraging Christians to live well. And part of that was he wanted to demonstrate that following the way of Jesus was good news for the world, including domestic life, which at the time it was very important. You know, domestic life has to be good. In his first century world, marriage was a building block for healthy society. In the 21st century, marriage is the same. It's still a building block for healthy society. We need strong marriages. And we live in a time where, of course, many people get married, but also divorce is common, or living together without getting married, and having children outside marriage happens more as well. But the data, the evidence shows that the way God intended marriage is still actually the way that works. For example, according to all the research, growing up in a home with your married mum and dad is by far the biggest predictor of positive life outcomes. In this setting, a child is less likely to have mental health struggles, end up involved in crime or even prison, more likely to do well in education, more likely to progress in work, and more likely to have successful long-term relationships themselves. This is not fashionable, but the data is overwhelming. A study by Princeton University 3 years ago called The Future of Children said this: reams of social science and medical research convincingly show that children who are raised by their married biological parents enjoy better physical, cognitive, and emotional outcomes on average than children who are raised in other circumstances. Now, of course, I have to say, if this is not how you grew up or not how you're raising a child right now, and it's outside this framework, it does not mean that you or they are doomed to a bad life at all. Doesn't mean that. But statistically, there is no doubt whatsoever, it's not even close, that marriage as God intended is the thing that works to make society work. It just is. And so there's a lot at stake here. We need to invest in our own marriages and support our friends' marriages and fight anything that gets in the way of them. So let's talk about marriage. Let's ask each other about it. And if we've got friends who are struggling and they need a few hours here and there in the busyness of work and kids, let's help each other out. Marriage is too important to the success of the world for us to passively neglect it. We can't do that. Final point, you'll be glad to hear. Be very, very, very careful about who you marry. Set the bar high. And I know like not everybody needs to hear this because of whatever situation you're in, but even if one or two people in the room need to hear this. Sometimes we can believe, because it's what our culture tells us, that finding that special someone who completes you is the thing you absolutely need. That's not true. Anyone here who's been married knows full well it does not solve all of your problems. Does it? Are you elbowing Martin? Yeah. In fact, not only does marriage not solve your problems, it might bring some. There are many good things about being single. Singleness brings different opportunities and different challenges. But what's a disaster is marrying for the wrong reasons. Some of that's obvious, like marrying because the other person's physically attractive and nothing more. But more commonly, I've seen people get married simply because they want to be married. And so they've married somebody who's not a great fit for whatever reason. That's a terrible idea. If marriage is sharing a life, a house, a bed, chores, maybe kids, a bank account, in a permanent partnership, it's wise to be extremely cautious about who you marry. You're not going to marry someone who fixes your problems. You're not going to complete them either. But marriage can be great, and there are better and worse choices about who to marry. If you're ever thinking of marriage at any point, please consider stuff like this. Marry someone who moves you towards Jesus. Marry someone you genuinely trust. Marry someone who'll be your closest friend and advocate. Marry someone who you'd still be with and would still be with you, even if either of you got very sick or lost your looks or lost their job, etc. And finally, marry someone, and related to this passage, marry someone you can submit your preferences or agenda to, knowing they won't abuse the privilege. And so let's wrap this up. While passages like today's one can be used out of context to justify some really bad behaviour, and some of us have had that happen to us, what's actually going on is that God is asking us to sacrificially love others, to take marriage seriously, and to represent him even in our closest relationships. The idea that God wants anyone to be oppressed, male or female, married or single, by anyone else is completely turned upside down when we remember that everything the Bible says about the practicalities of life is built on the message that actually Jesus allowed himself to be oppressed, to suffer, to die, to free us, not to squash us. He already submitted himself for us. And that's why we worship like we do today, in response to what he did already. So as we think about our relationships, let's build it on him. Start with him, who he is, what he did for us, before we get into the nitty-gritty and some of the more controversial bits and pieces. Before Martin and Bayzee come and lead us again in singing, I'd just like us to spend a bit of time in prayer as a whole congregation. So I'm going to sit down. There'll be a bit of space for a couple of minutes before they start praying and leading us in singing again. Why don't a few of us just pray out on behalf of all of us in relation to what we've been talking about? Would it be okay to do that? Thank you.